يمكن مساعد. أنا سارة حياتي،
أنا بحكم السكشواليتي بتاعتي أنا هومو.
حجازي خلعت الحجاب في عام 2016 وأعلنت أنها مثلية الجنس وناشطة شيوعية.
وإزاي حصل ده على أرض مصر إن علم المثليين يرتفع على أرض مصر الطاهرة؟
شكل خبر انتحار الناشطة المصرية المدافعة عن حقوق المثليين سارة حجازي صدمة.
رفع المثليين يا الله.
سارة حجازي
ماتت مرتين.
حديث مواقع التواصل الاجتماعي بعد انتحارها ما بين متعاطف معها ومنتقد لمثليتها.
إلى أي مدى جدد انتحارها الجدل حول الحريات في مصر والعالم العربي؟
يمكن سعيد، أنا سارة حياتي.
You were just listening to the voice of the late Egyptian LGBTQ activist Sara Hejazi. Sara's life was marred by rebellion and ultimate tragedy. She fought a brave struggle right till the very end. This podcast, Justice for Sara Hejazi, explores Sara's life from the perspective of those who knew her personally, as well as academics who studied the phenomena of what Sara came to represent later in life. The podcast is brought to you by myself, Maysa Ajjan, student at the Lebanese American University, and is part of my master's final project. Sara Hejazi's suicide in June 2020 sent Arab and international media into a flurry of coverage and speculation as they struggled to adequately respond to the magnitude of such an event. However, it was not only journalists who rushed to weigh in on the subject, but academics as well. This podcast, Justice for Sara Hejazi, hosts two of the most brilliant Arab academics who identify as queer, Dr. Tariq Bakouni.
Thank you, Maysa, for the introduction and for the opportunity to be on this podcast.
And Dr. Zeina Zaatari.
Thank you for that question.
Each of Tariq and Zeina penned a brilliant article commemorating Hejazi and her activism in the Arab world. Their articles touch upon sexuality in the Middle East, the challenges of the LGBTQ community in the Arab world, and other subjects. Tariq Bakouni, you are a writer. You serve as the board of Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, one of the few independent transnational Palestinian think tanks. You also serve as the book review editor of the Journal of Palestinian Studies, and you are co-founder of Makan. You are also well-versed in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, having Palestinian roots yourself, and having served as the former senior analyst for Israel, Palestine, and economics of conflict at the International Crisis Group based in Ramallah. Your writings have appeared in the London Review of Books, the New York Review of Books, The Baffler, The Nation, Skin Deep, The Washington Post, and much more. You are currently writing a manuscript about queer love in Amman, and as I understand, you are an openly queer academic. Now, my first question. You penned a groundbreaking article for independent outlet Mada Masr following Sara Hejazi's death in June 2020. The article is titled, "Our Lives Are Not Conditional," on Sara Hejazi and estrangement. In this article, you indirectly identify yourself as a queer man by using the pronoun we when you want to speak of the LGBTQ community. You also state that Sara, quote unquote, did not take her own life, but was killed by our society's smallness and its incapacity to make room for the breadth of her humanity. These are bold claims to make. Do you really believe that society kills people like Sarah Hijazi?
I think that the way that we need to have this conversation is to understand that there are vulnerable segments of any society that feel the brunt of the structural violence that that society harbors against them. So these are communities that are unable to get access to healthcare, whether physical or mental healthcare, that are unable to form social ties out of development, that are marginalized economically and politically. The impact of structural violence on these communities cannot be underestimated. So when I say, or when I write, that Sarah Hijazi was someone who was killed by that kind of nationwide erasure of queer people in Egypt, what I'm really saying is that there's systematic violence against people like Sara and like her colleagues, her comrades, and her allies who suffer under the brunt of that kind of persecution. So even though Sara, of course, took her own life and committed suicide while in exile in Canada, we have to put that in the broader context of understanding what would have caused or enabled or facilitated someone's journey towards that kind of despair. We need to be able to understand the broader context in which Sarah Hijazi's life unfolded in Egypt and that ultimately led to her exile into Canada and put her death within that context.
You're listening to the Justice for Sarah Hijazi podcast. We just heard from Tariq Bakouni on how Sarah was killed by a society that marginalizes queer communities. Up next, Zeina Zaatari on Sarah Hijazi and sexual struggles. Are a queer feminist hailing all the way from South Lebanon, and for the past 25 years you have been working on gender and racial justice in Arab and Arab American communities, both within academic and nonprofit spaces. Before joining University of Illinois Chicago in 2019, you worked for the organization Research Political Associates. You've also taught courses in anthropology, gender, and sexuality at several universities. As for your publications, you have plenty of well-recognized studies in the gender and sexuality domain. Your most recent publications include a co-edited book with the brilliant academics Saad Joseph and Lina Mirai, titled The Politics of Engaged Gender Research in the Arab Region, Feminist Fieldwork and Knowledge Production. You also have the article, Sarah Hijazi and the Struggle for Freedom, which will be the subject of our discussion shortly. You have Lebanon in Arab Family Studies, Critical Reviews, edited by Saad Joseph, as well as Social Movements and Revolutions in a Companion to the Anthropology of the Middle East. And you have Desirable Masculinity, Femininity, and Nostalgia of the Anti-Modernity, Bab al-Hara television series as a site of production in Sexuality and Culture, 2014. You are also co-editing with Saad Joseph the Handbook of Women in the Middle East. Suffice it to say that you are a prolific researcher and you have produced plenty of knowledge on gender and racial justice. Zeina Zaatari, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Nisa.
Our first question to you is this. You penned an article called Sarah Hijazi and the Struggle for Freedom in 2020, shortly after Sarah Hijazi's death. In this article, you speak about several themes, such as queer identities, intersectionality, social rights, sexual rights, and movements, and other themes. What do you think is important for people to know about Sarah Hijazi when thinking about the struggle for freedom?
I think that what's important is to understand what Sarah Hijazi embodied, which is that queer sexual rights, whichever terminology we want to use, are part and parcel of the larger struggle for freedom, dignity, and social justice. And that, as she saw, the forces and the systems and the structures that were oppressive in Egypt, but in many other parts of the world as well, intersected, you know, whether it was patriarchy or whether it was, you know, authoritarian regimes, classism or capitalism, racism, etc., that these systems were intersecting and produced realities that were very oppressive for many communities, many individuals, but it also in different ways for many individuals, right? So that the experiences of someone who may understand their sexual preferences or their gender identity, you know, in particular ways, may experience a lot of these systems of oppression somewhat differently from someone who may consider them gender identity to be more normative. But yet the struggles are interconnected and the same, and the experiences that individuals are going through, you know, are come out of these systems of oppressive structures. So I think it's important to understand Sara within the larger context of the region, within the political, economic, human rights frameworks that are in the region, to understand that as also a product of the aftermath of what's called the Arab Spring and the transformations that were taking place in the region. So, you know, we wouldn't want to take Sara out of that context and understand her struggles when she was in Egypt and later in Canada as part and parcel of her community's struggles.
You're still listening to the Justice for Sara Hijazi podcast. Being a Sara Hijazi fan, I couldn't help but wonder what made Sara so charming yet polarizing at the same time. Here's what Tariq had to say about the matter.
I think that's a very good question. I mean, I think that a lot had to do with Sara herself, with her personality, the way that her comrades spoke about her, the way that she lived her life, speaking truth to power and being grounded in her own ideals. But this was my hesitation for your earlier question about personalizing this. The power of Sara's experience and Sara's story and the power of how it ended is personal, because it could have been any one of our stories, any one of us who was born and raised in the region, who identifies as LGBTQ+, or identifies in any way as being outside of the dominant heteronormative culture, can suffer persecution and the trauma of being forced to live abroad, if that is not your intended desire. Many of the members of the LGBTQ+ community from the region live abroad because they think this is the only way for them to have love lives and even a quality of life that is safe and that allows for their self-actualization. The fact that Sara had to flee Egypt and be in exile, be in Canada, away from her family, when that was not her first choice. This is a sentiment that many of us feel very closely, and we're always conflicted about feeling very grounded and rooted in the region and wanting to be in the region, and at the same time feeling a sense of push out of the region, a sense of alienation that we can't be in the region because that always comes at the cost some part of our being. And so I think Sara's experience, the way it unfolded, also the fact that it came under attention in the Mashroa Leila concert, in this sort of moment in time when people identified an opening or a possibility for us to be and present, and to have ended in that horror, I think that was something that many members of the LGBTQ plus community from the region were able to relate to very closely. And so it resonated, that story resonated. So it stopped. Of course, it's about Sada, but it's a story that all of us identify with.
Putting charm aside, have you ever thought that now would be the best time to have a sexual rights movement? Zina Zaatari weighs in with some food for thought as she defines sexual rights movements and talks challenges, oppression, and a potential fourth movement in the Middle East.
Maybe I can start with the challenges, since there seem to be a lot. So just also a note before to explain at least how I understand movements, which is not necessarily, an entity that's like has a beginning and an end. Even though when I'm writing, you kind of try to create some kind of an order by speaking about first wave, second wave, third waves, and possibly a fourth wave. But the language of waves at least allows for us to think of these things as constantly in movement and shifting, and engaging with one another. So, I think that there's always work happening to help build movement, but sometimes the social conditions within it exist, different, elements at place allows it to grow and kind of come up to the surface where we can see it more visibly, either through, for example, huge protests or some other form of organizing. And then at other times it wanes down where it's still kind of bubbling underneath, but it may not be as visible because the work of movement, is on some level a constant. Those who are really invested in creating change are always looking for ways to, amass more power, to mobilize more people, to transform messages and practices and ideas in our world, right? So I think the challenges right now are tremendous because we see a major backlash that we're witnessing across the region that's reverberating. And I'm talking particularly for LGBTQI activists, but not only, right? So we had a lot of hope, if you will, and momentum with the early parts of the Arab Spring, but then we have seen tremendous backlash politically, and Egypt is that one strong example where we're back to sort of a military dictator regime that is in tremendous control in the country that has shrunk, enormously the space for organizing on all fronts and in all areas for people. And that continues to jail many activists, lawyers, and journalists as well, right? So there's a tremendous backlash. And a lot of that is obviously expected because when organizers are transgressing norms and boundaries, that has always historically led to retreats, to fears, to threats, right? Breaking oppressive systems does not take place without resistance, something we see everywhere in the world. The backlash, if you will, is the structure or the system itself trying to recreate itself in different ways, or trying to regain its power. Denise Candioti, who's a feminist researcher, talks about patriarchy restructuring itself, particularly after the Arab Spring, where we start seeing these violent interactions with women, whether through the gang rapes in Egypt or some of the other ways that police was engaging with folks in Tunis and elsewhere. And so it's an attempt to regain that power or that control, right? Because people took to the streets as movement grows and those elements of fear, people took to the streets where women were important players in that field. that's kind of breaking these systems of oppression, shaking them, attempting to crumble them. But they work to reconstitute themselves and so find avenues to regain power and domination. So that's backlash. So on the one hand, there's a growing visibility of difference that, you know, is definitely different, let's say, than the moment I grew up in Lebanon, right? And, you know, I grew up in the 70s, 80s. Difference was harder to kind of come by. And it was, you know, because of sectarianism, because of the civil war, et cetera. The difference was often led to often to violent results. But we are seeing that there's a growing visibility of difference that is infiltrating, you know, daily life, including by people who look or behave a little bit different than the norm. And then there are a lot of folks working to carve out spaces and sort of dismantle policies and practices as well in society. So that is being met on some level with this backlash that we're witnessing. But that at the same time, this struggle I also see as an opportunity, because you're asking me about, you know, where are the challenges and the opportunities for a growing or a formation of a fourth wave sexual rights movement. Because as people understand that, well, these norms that we learned in our society, or that are that the sort of state, the families, religious institutions are working so hard, the educational systems, to reinforce, actually, if they can start seeing how these were made and not given, they're not necessarily natural, right? So what results in that is the idea that they can be unmade. So if they're being made by these forces and reinforced, they can also be unmade. And when you start seeing that some people are being able to do that, even if it's through creating smaller spaces for them to be able to exist and thrive that look different than the norm, that there are possibilities. And once you see that there are possibilities, it's hard to, you know, then go back and say, I'm going to stay put and not work towards creating that transformation. So I do think that there are local challenges. There are challenges that have to do with the current political moment and climate, the economic, obviously, especially in Lebanon and Egypt right now. A lot of context that makes it harder to organize and mobilize people. And at the same time, there are always elements within society that you know, need to create change, partly because they also want to thrive in the world that they're living, partly because they see that you know, these systems are just going to continue to disempower and oppress people, and so there has to be places for change. And so the opportunities have also been in the number of organizers that have grown since after the Arab Spring, that are working towards creating these kinds of changes.
While Zeyna might be certain about the presence of sexual rights movements, Tariq is not so sure. Stay tuned to the Justice for Sara Hijazi podcast to find out what he had to say.
Well, as I said, I think it's very hard to sort of speak about a queer movement in sort of a regional sense, because I'm not sure that there is one. I think in each country there's an ecosystem of activists and organizations that are working, very many of them underground, some of them becoming more vocal and more open. Mm-hmm. I think where it's going is still a matter to be discerned. So, for example, the situation in Egypt is quite troubling. After the revolution, we have a counter-revolution in the form of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's government that's actually more draconian on the LGBTQ issue than previous governments. So the The small, the sliver of hope that many felt around queer rights in Egypt has been driven during the revolution, has been driven underground, and the movement has pretty much completely been decimated. In other places, in other countries, the conversations are unfolding in different ways. My big fear when thinking about the future of queer rights is that authoritarian regimes in the region will continue to view this society or this segment of society as one that can be policed and criminalized in order to deflect from the authoritarianism or the authoritarian policies that these regimes have elsewhere, and that the members of the LGBTQ plus community, the more vocal they become through social media and through other online platforms, the more vulnerable they become to state repression.
As human beings, we tend to confuse heroes with the movements they are part of. In her article, Zena talks about heroes and says that Sarah never wanted to be one. Does she think focusing on movements is more important than focusing on heroes?
I would say mostly yes. So I didn't know Sarah personally. I knew people that knew her. And so when I say that she didn't seek to be a hero, I'm not like, I don't know that for 100%, but I do, from what I see in her writing and her activism, I see, someone who's really deeply involved in community and in collective work and organizing, basically in the movement, right? And so I do think that it is more important for us to focus on movements. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, we shouldn't tell the stories of individuals that helped galvanize movements, or individuals that were, whose, you know, intellect, whose strategy, whose spirit, whose love actually, helped build community and build movement. I do think that that is also important to address. I just always feel that sometimes we make people heroes after they pass. And in this case, what if we made Sarah a hero before she committed suicide? Would that have helped her continue being part of the movement? Right. And so I think sometimes we focus a lot on heroes as an exception or as an afterthought, you know. So sometimes we have descriptions of these great women in history that did this and this and this, but then they don't become, you know, part of our full psyche and understanding of what women are capable of. They become these exceptional women that are different. That's what I mean by I think it's more important to focus on movements than on heroes. And I think that the folks that we think of as heroes a lot, sometimes, who are really embedded in movement, really worked hard to build the movement. And the movement has a lot of other elements. You know, there are the daily work. There are the people who put forth strategy. There are the people that put forth specific, ideas and ideologies. There's the people that sing, there's the people that, you know, dance. All kinds of people constitute a movement. It's important to understand the complexity of how movements are built to better, in that sense, we may be kind of highlighting more heroes than the traditional ways in which we think of a hero.
You're listening to the Justice for Sarah Hijazi podcast. How did Sarah's death push conversations on queerness in the Arab world, especially regarding academia? Stay tuned to listen to Tariq's answer.
I think in some ways it was a milestone. I think people who work in this field and who are activists or academics or writers in this field understand that this was a significant moment in the history of the queer movement in the region. But at the same time, it's very difficult to pinpoint it as a turning point of sorts. I think that there's a lot of activity that's happening kind of, I think in various countries, this manifests in different ways. There are very localized social and economic and political factors that shape how queer lives unfold and how they organize as a movement in these various countries. But I also think that there is a kind of regional dimension that something like Sarah's death sort of resonates with people from across different countries. It's very hard to speak of a queer movement across the region because I don't think there is one, and I don't think that it necessarily unfolds in a regional sense there. But there are these moments or there are these glimmers that put these conversations in a regional perspective. But in each of the different countries, I mean, I think that there are more and more spaces that are opening up for these conversations to happen, largely because of social media and because of the fact that state censorship of these conversations through various ways, censorship of the media and of the criminalization of public conversations around these issues. I think it's much more difficult to manage that conversation in the age of social media. So I do think that there's a kind of openness that's happening, that's taking, I think, over the past decade or so, that's taking the movement into new territory because of the connectivity of the queer movement in various countries in the region to other countries in the region and to the global conversation on these issues.
After her death, many people depicted Sarah as, quote, deviant or bad because of her sexuality. They fought an open war on social media. Listen to Zena, who is a media and gender expert, comment on the subject.
I think it was clear that right after the news broke out about Sarah, that the media, like you had asked before, we mentioned, was maybe polarized, but that we saw a lot of folks take on to their social media outlets to try and, I guess, spread their ideas about Sarah, but not only about Sarah, but about all LGBTQI communities, about what it means to be different. What does religion allow or not allow? Promoting very particular understandings of society, that there were a lot of debates taking place. I knew a lot of folks from Egypt that, maybe lost friends on their Facebook page or whatnot because, it became like a debate, a war debate on some level. So we saw a representation that depicted Sarah as deviant, right? And all LGBTQI folks as deviant. We also saw a representation that attacked her for her communism, her ideas around class and capitalism in the world. We also saw a lot of folks that maybe were connecting the fact that she committed suicide with her sexuality and gender identity as if that was proof that that's deviant or that is an illness, because the discourse of homosexuality as an illness is a common discourse in the media as a whole in the region. As well as, for many people in terms of social media, or others that saw that, this was a punishment on some level because of her deviance, right? So there were a lot of these images circulating. At the same time, I did see, maybe not immediately, maybe a bit later, that also mobilized many of the friends, family, but also organizers around gender and sexuality in the region to speak up more about how the media is representing LGBTQI communities or mujtama al-mim and what and sexual rights and intersectionality, trying to create infographics or short videos, etc., to respond to this narrative and attempt to shift the narrative on these issues. So I think that there was a lot of, you know, like you were saying, polarizing perspectives, but there were also a lot of folks attempting to provide a bit more level of education. And I think it was in the, you know, several associations like the Lebanese Health Association. Maybe I shouldn't say that because I don't remember exactly their name. But anyway, there were several medical associations that decided to come out, you know, clearly indicating that like homosexuality is not a deviance. It's not one of the, it's not considered an illness. And that it is a natural part of human sexuality. So,
you're listening to the Justice for Sarah Hijazi podcast. In Egypt and other countries in the Arab world, queer communities are being subjected to violent crackdowns. We asked Tariq about the motivations behind these severe measures.
Often case, it actually has to do with an attempt by these authoritarian regimes to deflect from their incompetence elsewhere, whether it's social policy or economic policy. So for in the case of Egypt, for example, it's often been the case that attacks against members of the LGBTQ plus community happens as a way of deflecting from economic malaise and from poor economic policies that the regime has. And so often, and this is, by the way, not something that's rooted or that's exceptional to the region. I think we've seen examples of this in other authoritarian regimes and in other democracies as well, where in order to deflect attention from a certain shortcoming, the governing body positions LGBTQ plus community or other communities that are marginal and vulnerable as foreign agents or as agents that are undermining the security of a certain state. And so they then take very strong action against these communities as a way of asserting power and as a way of asserting dominance and showing that they are taking care of whatever foreign infiltration or foreign agents undermining social values, social culture, state security, whatever the case might be. And so this is how it manifests. I think in the regional situation, and members of the LGBTQ plus community are often portrayed as foreign agents. So they're Western agents. They're seen as coming with a Western agenda. And they don't belong to the region. They want to undermine our values and our family structure, our economy in some cases. And so they become demonized as non-Indigenous, as external impurities that need to be purified or dealt with. Doing this and or positioning them in this way allows the apparatus of the regime to project power and to act in a way that solidifies its authoritarian tendencies. So they become a scapegoat. They become scapegoated in that kind of structure.
That was Tariq's analysis on why regimes clamp down on queer Arab communities. He now weighs in on what can be done to prevent more suicide cases among the LGBTQ community. Listen to his opinion on the podcast Justice for Sarah Hijazi, and be sure to check the podcast description for more resources on suicide.
And I have to emphasize here that there are networks of support that exist, even in situations where the state does not provide that support and openly criminalizes that support. I have to say that there are very strong underground scenes in most countries in the region where there is communal support and solidarity that is provided. Unfortunately, because of the kind of oppression that these communities live under, much of that support is either inadequate or it's not provided in a manner that is able to deal with the mental health and psychological trauma of living underground. And so, for example, I'll give the example of Palestine because it's one of the areas I'm most familiar with. There are very strong organizations like Al-Qaws, which is based in Jerusalem and which provides support for members of the LGBTQ plus community. But organizations like that are also often caught in the political crossfire because of the fact that they become organizations that can be persecuted, that can be attacked, that the hegemonic states try to under defund or criminalize. And so I think in answer to your question about what can be done to reduce the risk of suicide and other mental health disturbances is to create more space for communal support. Unfortunately, that has to be underground now. But hopefully, at some point in the future, for the healthcare professions in these countries to take it on as a responsibility to provide mental health care for members of the LGBTQ plus community.
You're still listening to the Justice for Sarah Hijazi podcast. Telling a personal story can be gut-wrenching, especially if you relate to the main character. Here's how Zena identified with Sarah and how she impacted her work and life.
The fact that I identify as a queer feminist and as someone who has been doing research on feminist and queer movements for several years, I did feel that it was important to write something which has broader audience as opposed to, you know, writing academic articles behind paywalls that only other academics maybe read. And actually, you know, one of the editors in Merip approached me, who was also a friend, and asked if I would consider writing this piece. And I had been struggling with feeling, like many others, you know, this the feelings I mentioned, like feeling really angry and also feeling sad at that so much, you know, we say in Arabic, like leshul aher halad, like it's just, you know, so much pain, if you will. And I also felt a responsibility in many ways because I had spent some time researching, you know, sexual rights movements in the region. I had interviewed a number of activists, and the article that, you know, was going to be published had been delayed academically, and I felt by the editors. So I wanted to find a place to be able to share some of these stories and narratives and conclusions that I had achieved through the research and the thoughts that came from those really who, like Sarah, had been really in organizing on these intersectional issues, on sort of ways in which our lives are intermingled and interconnected.
Tariq was also affected by Sarah's story in his own way. Here's what he shared.
As I said, I think the story of Sarah was one that was very personal to me. I identified with her experience, and I thought that it was more important than ever to push the boundaries in terms of this conversation, to be able to write more, to show that hers isn't a unique voice. It's unique in the sense of her life and her politics and her extraordinary impact on the conversation and on the context in Egypt, but that there are many other voices and individuals that are being persecuted, and that the erasure of that conversation from the mainstream needs to be challenged. So it's sort of given me a greater sense of motivation to write more around this issue and to try to push for broader narratives in the region that makes space for queer lives.
You are listening to the podcast Justice for Sarah Hijazi. We've reached the end of our second episode, but our journey is far from over. Our topics touched upon Sarah Hijazi and the sexual rights movement, LGBTQ activism, and of course, Sarah's effect on a whole generation. This podcast was produced by myself, LAU student Maysa Ajan, with the goal of amplifying a counter-alternative narrative about Sarah. By interviewing my guests and highlighting their expert views, I aim to provide a justice frame for Sarah through the narratives provided by my guests. I am aware that the content for this podcast may be triggering for some listeners, which is why you can check out the Justice for Sarah Hijazi podcast description for resources. Thanks for tuning in.